working with Holly, and she's with FSU's art program, and she wanted to do a project about agriculture in Gadsden County. And to do that, we're learning more about some of the experiences, the issues, the successes that farmers have faced throughout their careers and their lives, and also kind of the history of agriculture in that area and how things have changed. And so we wanted a variety of different perspectives. So we've been interviewing lots of different people, and I think that you're going to actually provide a pretty interesting perspective because you did some things different than some of the other folks that we've interviewed so far. But the idea is that with these oral histories, we're getting your knowledge, your experiences from your perspective, and then that can color some of how we look at the history and how we can, you know, make things better in the future, and people can learn from it. So all of the oral histories that we've collected will go to the state archives, and that's where I work, and we preserve all of that for the future. People can come in and access it for research and educational purposes, so it's made available to the public. With your permission, of course. And then also Holly wanted to turn it into an exhibit. So kind of the public element, the public facing element, is that people can come to the exhibit and learn about agriculture in Gadsden County. And I know you live out of the county now, but.
Well, I was there for 50 years.
Yeah, so. So and then I guess I'll start out. My name's Amanda Hardiman. I'm here with Eric Griffiths, and we'll be talking to James Brown about his life and career. And can you start out by giving me your name and date of birth?
Name, James Brown, Jr.
Can we have the recorder going?
Did you say today's date?
Today is June 24th, 2018. Where are we? Can you tell us the address or the town?
Well, it's identified as Wigham. Wigham, W-H-I-G-H-A-M. Wigham, Georgia. I thought it was Calvary, but it's Wigham, they say. That's my mailing address, at least here.
We're not too far from Tallahassee. It was a pretty nice drive in.
Yeah, we drive down all the time. We are actually 15 miles from Bain. He at my farm. I'm 15 miles to Bainbridge. I'm 15 miles to Cairo. I'm 30 miles to Thomasville. I'm 30 miles into the city limits of Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. It's about 30 miles.
Is that a pretty good location for you?
For me, it is. We liked the farm, the wife, more than I did when I moved here. I also have a little farm in Havana. I got about 14 and a half acres. It adjoins to Lake Francis in Havana, that subdivision. I have part of the highway frontage that Lake Francis was built kind of behind from the entrance of the highway, which is Fairbanks Ferry Road from Havana. This is where we live at, and my home is the next home on the other side of that one you see there. I live in the two-story one up there. And in this farm, when I purchased it, was 300 acres, and I've gotten rid of a lot of it because I just had no use for it.
Well, I guess we'll backtrack a little bit. Can you tell me where you were born and what your parents did and kind of growing up, what that was like?
As a kid growing up, where we were at, we was in Havana, south of Havana, in a little area that was named Tin Top. That's what they call the community. Well, the farm area where I grew up at on this farm as a kid. And my mother and father worked on the tobacco farm, which was owned by P.W. Sheffer, was the farmer. He was not one of the large farmers, but he grew maybe about 20, 30 acres of tobacco. And that's where we grew up there, as I grew up there and my family there as a kid. And my father and Mr. Sheffer grew up from kids together. And when my father stayed on the farm, I must have been about 9 years old. And Mr. Sheffer wanted him to get off the farm and do something else. They were just good friends. He didn't want him to stay on the farm. So we moved from the farm, and Mr. Sheffer sold us a home in Havana. Sold my daddy a home and financed it for him. And that's where I grew up, which was right in the area. Okay. I didn't want to see that big Ben cap.
I got you from up here.
Yeah. Okay. I grew up after we left the farm. It was in Havana, but we didn't live in the congested part of Havana. I don't know if you know where May Nursery is. Going into Havana from Quincy. It's a big nursery named May Nursery. We grew up kind of in that area because the home where I grew up was kind of in that area. So we wasn't like in the town. Well, it was in the city limits, but it wasn't where all the housing was. We was kind of like in a little isolated area, which I loved that. And my mother, she worked on the farm until, I would say, until she stopped working. My father, when we bought the home for Mr. Sheffer, he started working with the Leon County Road Department. He started building bridges and that kind of stuff. He worked with the Road and Bridge Department until he retired. And then after he retired, he and Mr. Sheffer start doing things together around the farm again. He was older then, but he'd go over and help Mr. Sheffer harvest the pecans because tobacco was gone then. Tobacco left Gadsden County around 1975, 76. That's when it disappeared from Gadsden County. And before then, I had the opportunity to ride with the can't even think of the guy's name now, but he used to take photos of the farms from the air, you know, fly in the little two-seater around and take pictures. And I got the opportunity to ride with him once. I owned a plumbing company then in Tallahassee. And it was just amazing to look at Gadsden County from the sky. You didn't see no white cloth. It looked like snow on the ground if you were up north. Just everywhere was just covered with tobacco fields. I didn't know it was so much until I looked at it from the sky. Gadsden County made a lot of money off the tobacco. I searched the history out later. I love history. So I searched the history out later and find out that the farmers made a lot of money off the tobacco during those years. And the labor was cheap. Most of them, when the farming left, most of them just didn't do anything else. A lot of them start taking the farms and building subdivisions, like it's an area called Reston and, the Butlers, which were the largest farmer, I would say, around Gadsden County. The Butlers start building homes and developing a lot of their land in the subdivisions. And Mr. Butler and I become good friends because I was his plumber. And I admired him. He came from a family over on the East Coast over there, up around north of Brumby, St. one of those. his family come from there, and they had a lot of slave history. Matter of fact, his family owned over 700 slaves at one time on the plantation. They were powerful people back in the day. But Mr. Butler was one of the nicer men I met. I never heard him curse. I never seen him get upset about anything. And he worked a lot of people on his farm. And when farming went out, he decided to build houses for them. So he got government grants to build, it was called the 235 home. And he built homes for everybody worked on his farm. He put them in a home, and the little payments was about $40 to $50 a month, all they had to pay, you know. And they were all able mostly to get public jobs because the farming was gone. So I thought that was real nice of him. And then Coastal Lumber came during that time, and a lot of the people were able to get jobs over there. That's some of the, I guess, some of the public history. I knew all the farmers, though, around Havana. But like I said, there were very few black farmers because everybody worked in the tobacco. If you had a little piece of land, you couldn't afford to do anything with it. You know, you had to work where you could get a little check every month. Well, during those days, everybody was paid in cash. There were no, well, there were checks in existence, but nobody got a check. Everybody, you got your little money in a little manila envelope, with whatever the amount was, it was in there in cash. And when I first started working on the farm, I was about 7 years old, and they let me work in the barn where they would harvest the tobacco, and they string it on the stick, and then they hang it up in those barns. And if a leaf dropped on the ground, on the ground, because it was dirt floor, it dropped on the ground, my job was to pick up all the leaves off the ground at 7 years old. And that's what I did. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think I made $5 a week. I think that's what my salary was, about $1 a day. But I can tell stories of my father when he was a kid. He worked for 25 cents a day on the farm, 25 cents a day. That was his salary as a kid, and that would have had to been in the 20s or 30s, yeah, during the Depression time, you know. There were only one farmer, black farmer, and I talked with your friend about her. I mentioned it to her, but I couldn't get no history on him. I tried to dig up some from his family. His name was Bob Robertson. He lived right off of 27, just south of Havana. A lot of the family is still in that area, great-great-grandkids and whatnot. But his name was Bob Robertson, and he farmed, he raised, he had mules, a few mules. He had corn. He planted variety of vegetables, and I can remember as a kid, the first pomegranate I ate was at his house. He had all kind of fruit trees, and he did the cane. Everybody grew cane. He would make you cane syrup. He had a cane mill, and he made cane syrup for everybody in the area. He made it for black and white, everybody in the area, because he made good syrup, and so those are the kind of things he did. And he had the wagon and the mule. And I can remember as a kid, he'd come through by our house because we lived it on the south side of Havana when I was real young, before we moved to town. And he had the wagon with the seat in it. You know, you sit in the seat and the mule pull the wagon. And you go shopping to town to Havana every Saturday. You went shopping, you know, on the wagon. And there were many times when he passed the house, I would jump on the back of the wagon and get me a ride to town, you know. I probably didn't have 5 or 10 cents to spend, but I'd get a ride to town. And I'm smiling about it because it was exciting. Yeah, most of my friends said, man, no, that's a hard time. I don't even want to remember it. But it was an exciting time to me. as a kid, I was very obedient, so I didn't have no problems out of nobody. And I'd work hard, whatever I was told to do, that's what my father taught me to do. And I grew up with a pretty good life, I'd say. We had nothing, but I grew up doing pretty good and started my first business. I started my first business when I was in the, and I tell this story from time to time. I started my first business when I was in the third grade in elementary school. And because we were poor and I didn't have no money. So I get my little nickels and dimes and I saved them till I could buy a jar of peanut butter. And I bought a jar of peanut butter. Maybe a week or two later, I got enough money I could buy a jar of jelly. And then after then, I was able to buy me a loaf of bread. And I'll never forget it. Sunbeam Thin, it was called. It was long loaves, like, and I'd make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And I'd take them to school with me every morning. And before school start, I'd sell sandwiches to the kids for 5 cents each. And I can say unto this day, I've never been without a little money in my pocket. I mean, it may have been a few dollars, but I've never been broke. And that's where I, and that was exciting to me, to make my own money. And so I always desire to have my own business. And I start working with a plumbing company in Tallahassee in the early 60s. And I worked with them 5 years. And the last job I did was the Roadway Inn. And I was the foreman on the job. I did the Roadway Inn with a company out of Mississippi, was a contract on it. But I worked there. It used to be right out there where Home Depot, not Home Depot, where Holiday Inn used to be in town, you know, going out Appalachia Parkway. You remember that Holiday Inn used to be right there? I don't know if you remember them days. And Sears was on the other side of the street there from Holiday Inn. But anyway, Roadway was just, it's still there. It's not Roadway, I don't think, anymore. But when I finished the contract on it for the contractor I was working for the plumbing contract out of Mississippi, I got my license in Tallahassee, and I started my own plumbing business. I was 24 years old. I started my own plumbing business, and I never looked back, and it was good.
Now, you do a little farming now, right? Talk about what led up into the meat processing.
I might ask a question, but look at her when you're answering it, so it'll look good on me.
Yeah, I told him he could chime in.
I didn't hear how old you were, so I couldn't place those stories you were telling, like when you're in third grade, like what time period are you talking about?
53, had to be about 1953. I was in the third grade when I started selling my sandwiches. I was born in 1945.
Yeah, just need a point of reference there. Mm-hmm.
That's why I went on and said 1945. And about the farming, I didn't mention this. And I talked about some of this in Quincy, you know. But I didn't mention the farming. I was like the other gentleman that grew hogs. When I first got married, I started growing hogs, and I borrowed enough money to buy me one female, what we call a sow, and then I got the sow bred with another man that had a male, and I got my first litter of pigs, and I grew hogs for about 6 years, I grew hogs till I got my master of plumbing license. And I grew hogs and sold them in Quincy at, there were a company in Quincy named Frost & Moore. They were a big meat packing company. They were large. And they sold meat all over the country. And I sold my hogs there. But I started with that one hog, and I don't know how many I had when I stopped. I must have had 50, 75 maybe. But I eventually sold all the hogs because I started getting busy with my plumbing business with the customers, and I just forget the stinking hogs.
Did you get out before the hogs dropped out?
Oh, yes, way before. I got out, when I got out, it was in the 60s, late 60s. Couldn't have been no more than 70, I'd say, maybe early 70s. But I got out of it, had to be probably early 70s when I got out of it. I was just going to ignore it. I'll call him later. That's the guy coming down to get the equipment from Atlanta. And when the late, after I started with the University of Florida in Animal Sounds, I still owned the plumbing company during that time.
So when you were doing hogs, it was mainly just for extra income, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like I think the other guys just did it because they had jobs. And that was about the bulk. Now, there were other guys growing hogs too, black guys. I know, but I can't remember who they were because sometimes I would meet them at the Frosty Mowing. We'd be over there selling hogs, and I would be. But I can't remember who they were. It's been so long ago, since the late 60s, early 70s. I can't remember names. But after I started with the University of Florida, I started growing lambs and goats. I grew lambs and goats and bought a meatpacking plant in Quincy and built one. It was a small plant, and I built it. It was about 5,000 square foot plant. We slaughtered hogs, cows, goats, lambs. Matter of fact, we made a rabbit sausage while we were there. We were introducing in the mid 80s, the University of Florida and the research and the professors I was working with, we did a lot of I can't even think what we used to call it. But we used to go around the country, you know, and see what the possibilities of selling what I was going to process.
Okay. So I'm not sure you were talking about what you were doing with
the University of Florida, and I started the meat house, and I couldn't get, when we first opened the meat house, I couldn't get enough goats. We had found there was a demand for lambs and goats in the South, but nobody was processing. That's why I built the plant mainly to do lamb and goats. And we were going to do the oysters and the emus and all that, and it never did do very much. Matter of fact, I put a lot of money and a department there on the plant to do them, especially do them, because they have a lot of dandruff and dust in the feathers, and the USDA required us to have a special type unit to process them in, and it never did do anything. But the goat and lamb started out pretty good, not as well as the research we had done, or we intended it to do. And we found out the biggest problem was most of the people was people from other countries. And they didn't want to pay the American price for it. They wanted them for cheaper than I could really afford to sell them to them. I just couldn't. But we tried to work with that. And I finally found some markets in Miami and in that area that, because you had a lot of Jamaicans and island people down there. And I was doing pretty good with selling. We were shipping them down. I had refrigerated trucks and all that stuff. We were shipping them down there, and we were doing okay. And then a company in Texas built a plant to slaughter lambs and goats. And they were slaughtering like 500 to 1,000 per 24 hours. And they put me out of business. They eventually put me out of business. They were selling like a dollar and a half, $1.75 a pound, cheaper than I could sell. So I then just closed the meat plant down and went and bought a meat company in Atlanta. And that's where I ended up staying until I come back here. But we wasn't able to get enough lambs and goats. We were able to get enough hogs, but lambs and goats, I was not able to get enough of them from this, even up here. I bought from people around Thomasville, Cairo, Bainbridge, Colquitt, all through these areas. A few people had a few goats, but it wasn't enough to supply my demand. So we start, I bought a Dodge diesel truck with a long tandem gooseneck trailer, and we start hauling goats and lambs out of Texas because I could buy them for $10, $15 a head, and I was paying $30, $40, $50 for them around here. So I was doing pretty good until the company in Texas opened up the slaughter plant, and they basically just took the business from me, so I had to move away. I just closed it down, and I moved away eventually. I stayed here until I was like about 50 years old before I ended up going to Atlanta. And as far as I know, I was the first person to ever make a goat smoked sausage. I had them in the supermarkets. I had them in IGA's and some of the Publix and Winn-Dixie stores, but they didn't sell very good. It just what the time wasn't right. Now people eating lamb and goat because they recognize it's healthier than eating the pork and the beef. So now they eat it. So now you can sell it. I'm selling quite a bit here, lamb and goat. No, little bit of lamb, a lot of goat. And I have white and blacks that's buying it in the sauces. Or I cube it, and they make what they call a curry dish out of it, you know, like the Jamaican fix it. And I sell it that way. And it sells foul, not real good. In Atlanta, it sold real good, but not that well here. And that's about, you know, what I do here. And everybody in Florida that I know is trying to get me to go back there and open up something in the, maybe in the Tallahassee area. Something similar to what I have. It would be different than what I got here, but something similar to what I have and sell like the lamb and the goat meat and all the variety of sauces I sell, which I sell sauces you can't even buy in the supermarkets. I mean, nobody makes them. And my emphasis is on selling as healthy a sausage as I can to the public because I understand what's in the sausage. So I keep my sausages, I keep them pretty much frozen to preserve the sausage. If you're not going to put all the preservatives in it, that's what you have to do. But they taste better and they are healthier. My number one selling sauce is a chicken sauce that I make. When I first started here 4 years ago, my number one sauce was a pork sauce. And now about 85% of the people were eating the pork, not eating the chicken sauce. And they say it tastes better. Most of them say it tastes better than the pork sauce or as good. So they don't mind eating it. It digests better. And I could say some things about the chicken in the pork in the whatnot. I could say some things about them that I know from doing working in research, but it's the American diet. I mean, that's what we eat. You know, the healthiest animal we can eat is the deer, and I start doing them the next year after I open up because so many guys wanted me to do the deer for them, and so I demand that they process it. They got to skin it and gut it. And so USDA let me process it for them. and I do the deer on certain days, and I do my meat for sale on certain days, and it works good. But during the deer season, we work anywhere from 12 to 18 hours a day, just trying to get them, keep them moving out. It's a real good business, and a lot of people have recognized that the deer is healthy meat, and so you got a lot of guys hunting, I think, that wouldn't be hunting, but they want the deer meat. And if ever I have hunters bring deer to me and they don't pick them up, I keep a waiting list. USDA will let me sell them if they don't pick them up, just to get my money out of them. Other than that, see, deer is illegal to sell deer meat. It's game, so you can't sell it. When I had the company, the meat company in Quincy, I had a farmer, I can't think his name now. I keep wanting to call him Joe Walthall, which was a customer of mine, but I don't think that was his name. But he lived it out east of Tallahassee, right off of 10, before you get to the Monticello area. He had a big farm out there, and he grew the red deer, big deer. They grow out west and up north. But he had probably a couple hundred of them or more. And I'd go out and buy them from him, and I could sell that meat because it was considered domestic, see, because he grew them. But you couldn't kill them out. It's illegal to kill them out in the wild, you know, because it comes under game. And I sold them to the public. That, what's the name of it? Banjo's Barbecue. Used to be out on Appalachian Park with Banjo Barbecue. I used to... Hello? Hey. Okay. Are you going to be able to come before 5? Okay. Well, right now I'm doing an interview with a group from the state of Florida. So if you have you already left? Okay. Okay, well, you'll be a while. If you could give me maybe an hour. We'll be through with this for sure, and then, you know, we can take care of you and when you get here. That'll be good. Yeah. All right. Okay. See you then. Okay. Bye.
Yeah. Too much longer,
I know you're going to open in a little bit.
I remember you saying the other night about wanting to hand this place off but not being able to. Can you talk about the next generation coming up?
Well, and that's the saddest part of it, is the next generation. I have nobody but one son that would love to have it, and he worked with me in the meat company in Florida and Atlanta. He got a degree in criminal justice, and he was with the state of Florida for a number of years, and he ended up coming to Atlanta and running the meat department for me, because we did wholesale retail, and I couldn't handle it by myself because it looked like everybody, I hate to put this on camera, but it's the truth, it seemed like most of the people in Atlanta steal. I mean, I never seen so many thieves. And they were ripping me off so bad at the meat company till my son had to leave his job, and he came up and run the meat department for me. And that helped us with safety. The cameras didn't get it. I mean, I had cameras even in the coolers and freezers, but they still stole. And they were stealing big time, like, I was losing maybe some days $1,000 worth of meat in one day because we had a pretty good size operation going on. And when you're selling a lot of meat and big semis coming in and out every day, they figure out how to get you. and so he came up, and he knows the meat business well. A matter of fact, he's a salesman for one of the largest meat company in the United States. That's what he is now, and he's doing well there. And I couldn't ask him to leave his job and come. I wanted to give this to my youngest son, which seemed to have a problem keeping a job. And he don't want it. He just don't want it. That's the only reason I started it, was for him. He said he wanted it, but he don't really want it. And he's showing me he don't really want it. And I don't understand why he don't. He's working with a company outside in landscaping rather than to be in there where he's cool. And I was paying him more money than the company he's working with. Now, I hope somebody can answer that one for me. But he left me to work for them. But he'll help me when he's off. But he don't want the responsibility of the business. So that's my sad story about the meat business. I got two people are interested in it that would buy it, maybe, that want to buy it. I didn't want to sell it to them because I wanted to keep it in the family. But that's where it may end up. And when I put this here, I put it here. You can see the way it's designed. I got it so it can be moved. I had everything here bought here with a semi. And everything can be moved with a semi. Except the little store part where it can be moved. But that was built here. But the other parts, that's the smokehouse you see right there. See, it was all built in trailers. And then the stainless steel is our processing room. And the people from USDA were just shocked when they seen how I designed it on the inside. It was like, wow, I never seen anything exactly like this. You got it designed so neat and everything in order. But then I taught school, and I got a degree from FSU in industrial education. And so I learned how to set up assembly lines and create production. And so I knew how to build, because I built the meat plant too, but I knew how to build things to create that flow in the business. And it works real good. It works real good, the little facility we got there. But I know I'm going to end up letting somebody have it, you know, because about 3 weeks ago, I was 73. And I'm just ready to slow up and kind of do what I want to do. And the wife, she's been demanding it for 15 years. Why don't I slow up and spend more time with her and we do things together? And she deserves that. We've been married 53 years. We married right out of high school. And I want to give her some time while I'm still able to drive. I told her I'll be Morgan Freeman and you be Miss Daisy. And I do it now, but only when I have time. She can drive, but I'm the driver. We go to Canada and we go to Detroit about once a year. We go up there and stay, and I have to drive all the way up there and back. Now, we fly up. But I don't like flying like I do driving, because I like to stop in different areas. Like I told you, I love history. I get in the area I want to stop. I like to stop. I want to take me some pictures. I want to spend the night. I do that. And driving, you know, gives me the opportunity to do it. And so most of the time we drive up, and we'll probably be going up maybe by the end of July. We'll go up, because July is the month I close in July. July, August, and September. I used to close July, and then the wife pushed me to August and then to September. So now I close 3 months out the year. And they're my slowest month. When it get real hot, we as a people, and when I say we as a people, I'm talking about as a whole, all nations of people, eat less meat in the summer than we do the cooler, colder months. About eight or nine months out of the year, we sell a lot of meat. The summer comes, when I had the company in Atlanta, we sold more fish and chicken, turkey, chicken and fish in the summertime. The meat, beef and pork, even lamb and goat slowed up. Not stopped, but it slowed up considerably. So I figured those months is my best months here to close. So we'll close up those months. And mow grass. I got about 20-some acres here of grass I have to mow. I go about almost a mile straight back.
Do you keep any animals out here?
That's what I need. but then...
More work, too.
Yeah, well, even I had gotten a grant from the government, a free grant. I didn't have to pay the money back. They was going to help me fence in. They were going to pay 50% of it. And I couldn't figure out how I was going to see after the animals because I had started this, see, and it just wasn't enough for me. And then my son, like I say, he wasn't interested, and I've got a couple of farmers I've met around here that buy sauces, and I do deer for, they promised me, we'll help you with them. Because we here all the time with our cattle and stuff like that, and we'll help you see after. And I'm like, oh no, I don't want to have to depend upon anyone to see after them. So that's why I don't have any animals. All I have is some chickens. I got chickens and chucker quails. Those are two birds I grow, and we have them up there, and that's all I grow other than a garden.
So throughout your life, in terms of your career, you know, what were some of the hardships in doing agriculture, meat processing, the businesses you've had? What are some of the hard parts of it?
The hardest part was getting the USDA plant I had in Quincy started, because it demanded so much money to get it started, because everything had to come up the USDA requirements, you know. I got some great help from from A&M and from the University of Florida, because I was working with the University of Florida. I got some great help with things they could help me with, like drawing the plans to build a meat plant, and help me doing marketing. They had people there that helped me with all of those kind of things, and that was great help. But the hardship was the money to get everything approved and putting the building there and those kind of things. If I had not had the plumbing business, I never would have been able to do it. My plumbing business was good, so the money was coming in that I could afford to build it with, and it worked out real good. So I can't say it was any great hardship with that. It just wasn't that bad. I must say it wasn't that bad. The hard work, I mean, there was a lot of hard work in it, but I was used to that from the plumbing business, because I started in the plumbing business during the days when you dug the ditches with the shovel. There wasn't no backhoes and trenches. It was digging with the shovel and crawling under these little low houses, installing pipes. So I was used to the hard work. That didn't bother me, but there was a lot of hard work in it, and times when, you know, you're wondering if you're going to have the money to pay the employees when the weekend and pay everybody you owed for all the money you done borrowed from the different banks. And when I closed it down and left, one of my main bankers, he just knew, you know, they never would get their money that I left owing one bank over $250,000 when I went to Atlanta. And I know they felt like, from the conversations when they called me, that they wouldn't get their money. Because, you know, I had left the state of Florida. And I'm like, you will get your money. My father taught me, if you owe a man, pay him. And I did. I went to Atlanta, and within 3 years, I had paid them that $250,000 back in 3 years after I went to Atlanta. So Atlanta was good for me. The people are just there, and it's money there. It's a good place to do well, and it's a good place to do bad. I mean, if you stay focused, you can do well in Atlanta. And I've got a lot of black and white friends that's up there. I don't know, you ever heard of Claude Arrington? He was a state judge there in Tallahassee with the Capitol. He was an attorney before then. He and I were good friends through the years, and his son is in Atlanta now doing well. He's an attorney. And I know a lot of other people that went up that's doing well up there. And then I know a lot of people went up there and they're not even living anymore. So, somebody coming.
Okay, what would you tell someone who wanted to get into farming or processing in the future? What is some advice you'd give them?
I would say just what I said in the seminars I used to do for the University of Florida in the 80s. I think farming is one of the better things you can be. I told them then, in the future, I could see farming coming. It's a demand for food. Everybody's got to eat. And America today cannot grow enough food to feed America. All my lambs and goats come from New Zealand and Australia. All of my body. That's where they shipped in. Your beef now coming from Australia. I know that guy. He's a nice guy. He can go in if he wants to sit down in the AC. He'll be okay. But I see now just what I foreseen in the 80s, I see it happening now. We can't feed America. I have people that sell meats and vegetables and things like that, and they'll say, we sold out this week. We sold out. In other words, didn't have enough to meet the market demand. So if it's happening now, where's it going to be 20 years from now? I mean, that's one of the scariest things I see in America is food and clean water.
So with that in mind, why is it so hard for small-time farmers to get started, to get going? What could be done to help? Because you don't see many people doing it anymore.
No, they really don't seem to want to get into farming because I think they have this image of hard work. But see, farming is not hard work today. And I've learned more since I moved here. I've been here 12 years, and I've learned so much here. Because I find farmers, I'd love to have started in my 30s with the farm. If it wasn't but 50 or 100 acres, it's not hard anymore. Now, and John Deere, and I know it's one of them, you can get the equipment. You can get it on a lease program, or they'll fix it so you can get the equipment so you can farm like you want to. That gentleman in that truck right there, he works for a big farm, vegetable and produce, all this stuff, chemicals and feed and fertilizer. He manages it for him, that guy there. And he was telling me about this guy, one of their associates down in Florida. He was growing 50 acres of corn, green, you know, sell it fresh to the market. And he made $80,000 off of that crop of corn. And this is today's market, see? So, and corn is one of the easier things to grow. I mean, I grew corn back there. That's the only thing I enjoyed growing. Everything else I tried to grow, I was trying to get in the organic farm. That was my goal. When I come here, I was going to do maybe 30, 40 acres in a garden, organic farming. The guy's coming today to pick up my organic spreaders. That's what I'm selling. To spread the manure and stuff in the fields, because that's what we were fertilizing the soil with, instead of the stuff you put in the ground. I won't name any of it, but I'm letting him have that. But that's what I want to do. Now, my garden is organic. I got just for the family and friends. I give every day somebody come getting some out of it. I don't plant as much as I used to because I was disappointed with that. You can't give it away unless you harvest. They won't come up here and harvest it out of the field. Can't even give it away that way. So I don't understand people. You know, nobody wants to seem to want to work anymore. And that's sad. And that's where America was built, upon hard labor, you know. But nobody wants to work hard anymore. And there is a great demand for people that farm. And even if it's growing livestock, there's a demand for it. He's the guy there. They're getting in the goat farm, and they're starting a big herd. And he sees a market there. A goat, now, you can't buy a goat for less than about $150. I mean, from anybody. That's about cheap as you're going. They go from that to $800 for one goat, if he's purebred and he's of a certain breed. So, I mean, there's money to be made in farming. And it's such a relaxed lifestyle. You know, I taught school for 9 years and did all these different kinds of things in my lifetime. But it is the most relaxing thing to farm. And it's exciting. You see the vegetable pop up out the ground, and you see it grow, and then it produce whatever seed you planted. That's what it produced. And when it's ready to harvest, you harvest it. If you don't harvest it, it go bad in the field. It demands you to take care of it. I learned all that since I've been here. It demands you to take care. You can't say, oh, I need to cut the okra this week. Oh, but I won't worry about it. I'll cut them next week. They won't be any good next week. Or they may not be good tomorrow. You got to get them when they're ready. And God created things that way. Studying my Bible, I learned that He created everything. There's a season for it, and there's a time for it. Just like our tomatoes, and you buy avocados, you buy mangoes, you buy lots of your fruit. You buy. If you notice, 20 years ago, and you're all old enough to know that, it was so delicious. It's not as good as it used to be because they don't let it ripen in the sun. And that's, but it's the demand. See, the market demands you got to get it and get it, have it year round. But I eat like tomatoes. I eat the tomato out my garden, and they just starting to get ripe. I just give them all away, though. I'd give you some of them. They're so delicious compared to them you buy at the store.
It's a world of difference. Yeah. Do you have anything else?
No, I think that's
yeah.
But like I say, for the today's farmer, there is a demand for them, and I don't know any really, other than the people we met, but I'm going to do some research when I get off this summer, and I'll be getting back with you all because I got your numbers. I know there's some in Madison, Live Oak, going down toward Gainesville, because I worked with them when I was in research. There were some pretty good-sized farmers down, black farmers down there. But I just don't remember who they are, and it's the season when I don't have time to...
We did interview Michael Brown the other day, and he had a little bit different story. He seemed to be fairly successful. and had always done farming. His family did it and he did it. But I think the difference is that tradition played such a role in it. Mm-hmm. Even when it got bad, it was worth it to him to keep his family history going. He didn't, jump out.
Yeah. And that's what most guys did. When it got bad, they just didn't tough it out and say, hey, for better worse, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to make it work. And that's what happened. But I know one or two down in that area, they were big farmers. This was in the 80s. I mean, they were big cattle and hog farmers and vegetable farmers. Matter of fact, one farm I went on, this black farmer, they had their own church. That fascinated me. Built on his farm. There was a nice church. It wasn't just their family went to it. All the people in the area, that was, he built it for the community. And I thought, oh, that's me. Yeah. And he was a successful farmer because he was doing well. And it was one, I know, in the Madison area, Live Oak Madison area. And like I say, it was one down near, seemed like going between Lake City and Gainesville.
Seemed like Lake City.
You from Lake City?
Yeah, when my parents moved down there, the area we lived, all the land was owned by black people, like hundreds and hundreds of acres. And that's where they bought their little 5 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Was because I don't know how long they've been there, the families and stuff.
He lived next to a man that was 113, had owned a bunch of land.
I was telling her, driving up here, we passed like tobacco barns and stuff, mm-hmm. and it was the way it was in Lake City there.
Yeah. That's where my son was. He was a parole officer in Lake City. That's where he was when I took him to Atlanta, got him to come to Atlanta and help me. He was in Lake City.
Yeah,
he said he liked that area. Yeah, that's the area he was in. That's where he was.
All right. Thank you so much for your
okay.
time.
I wish you the time, like I say,
yeah.
was just not right. That.